The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Beautiful day, beautiful sunshiny day here at the Edstone campus in the heart of the UK. Had to run a couple of errands this morning, so I had the guys do a little extra research for me, and that was a big mistake. Too much material, too much to get into. Speaking of the material or the content of this program, I got a kick out of this email that came in last night. This listener says, I've enjoyed your magazine for years. I was wondering how you're able to find the worldwide news as reported in The Trumpet. I never see your news on TV. I never see what you talk about or what you cover at thetrumpet.com on television. And that's right. That's true. But it's not that it's not there. And I think it says something about our news gatherers as they are scouring the news sites, and we are drawing attention to stories that in most cases should be getting a lot more attention. That's what makes this program, that's what makes The Key of David, that's what makes The Trumpet Magazine so important. It's not like any other news source, for sure. It's just that we need more and more people to be tuning in. I was thinking about all these radio hosts that typically take a lot of time off at this time of the year. If all those listeners would just tune in to one of the programs on KPCG, that's awesome to think about. The reach of God's message, it will expand and grow. And of course, it's going to grow and eventually fill the entire earth, like it's prophesied in Isaiah 11. It's going to fill the earth, God's truth. What a wonderful time that will be when everyone can be exposed to the truth of God. On today's show, we're going to be talking about the far-right party in Austria, this far-right group that joined in with Sebastian Kurz's new coalition. And, I mean, no one seems to be very much concerned about it. But we're going to go through that in some detail and also consider the direction that Germany is headed in. I mean, they're in the midst of a coalition crisis as well. Well, I guess Austria's isn't a crisis, but it should be. It should be. I mean, where's the outcry? Here's this party formed by a Nazi, basically. And they're swinging right in with Sebastian Kurz's group. And nobody says anything. Nobody's concerned about it. That's coming up just in a little bit here in the first segment. Also, Sigmund Freud, this as more and more are now writing, a drug-addicted crackpot, really. We discussed him, I think, 3 weeks ago on this program, and we'll revisit the subject today thanks to an excellent piece at National Review. Just to follow up on something we discussed earlier this week as well, the leader of Turkey, Erdogan, he's challenging the United States by saying that he's going to open up an embassy in East Jerusalem. So there you go. If Trump's going to put an embassy in West Jerusalem, then Turkey's going to put one in East Jerusalem. See, everyone's picking sides. And of course, as I covered on the program the other day, most are siding, as we saw from that UN resolution vote on Monday, most are siding with the Palestinians. President Trump's made out to be the bad guy. That's from the Times of London. Another one from the Times says that Facebook finally admits that social media is bad for your mental health. And the opening of this piece says Facebook has finally conceded that social media can harm mental health, but it proposed that users improve their well-being by posting more updates and comments. They need to be more engaged. Don't just sit there waiting for a like or waiting for whatever they call all those things today. Be active. Be engaged. That's what Facebook has to say. That's the solution. More Facebook. If it's hurting you, well, then do more of it. I mean, actually, in an Isaiah 5 and verse 20 world, I'm sure that advice from Facebook probably sounds about right. Probably sounds like the truth. Well, I guess that's the solution. We need more of it. Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil. That's what the verse says. That put darkness for light and light for darkness. That put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. How honest it would have been for reps at Facebook to come forward and say, you know, these studies are true. And as much as we love our product, there is a balance. And you shouldn't get into it that much. But oh no, oh no, they've got a billion more users to try to find. And so they want to get you addicted. They want you to get into more of it. Those are just a couple of stories following up on things that we have discussed on this program previously. Well, the main thing I want to dwell on here for the next few minutes is an article that was at the Washington Times yesterday about the U.S. military and how it could lose the next war that it engages in. It's a sobering warning in this piece, right in Washington, D.C., right in the nation's capital city. Where will America be next? Where will the next battlefield be for the United States? And how will it turn out for the world's supposed lone superpower? In reading through William Manchester's book on Winston Churchill, we're right in the midst of the World War I period, and just some dreadful facts about the trench warfare that spread across the European continent, hundreds of miles, and people that were just dying by the thousands every day. I think Manchester said on an average day it was something like 2,500 young men slaughtered. Young Frenchmen, or Brits, or Germans, or Russians. Just an absolute slaughter. Both sides had armies that were just enormous. And one of the points that he brings out, Manchester does, is how that war and strategy and the technology had changed dramatically. Just in the decade or two leading up to World War I, offensive weapons were no match for the weapons that defenders had with the advent of machine guns and, of course, all the barbed wire that was between the trenches. And so you couldn't lead a charge like you might have been able to do 50 years previous. Or you'd just be mowed down. So there they were, entrenched, waiting for more offensive weapons to come along, like the armored tank and such. Churchill, of course, was involved in some of that development, quite a lot of it, actually. And as the book brings out, I mean, he was looking for any and every way that he could break the stalemate. I mean, I think by the end of 1914, this is just after the few first months of the war, there were already 1 million British and French casualties. 1 million young boys, teenagers, young men slaughtered in that battle. And so the Western leadership, they were desperate. They were looking for a way to break the stalemate. Maybe we can flank the German forces, come in from the south through the Dardanelles. Any and every way that they could possibly bring this to an end, and of course it didn't come to an end very quickly, did it? It carried on for 3-4 years. The point that I want to make here is that, I mean, the technology and the way in which wars are fought, it's always changing, and you have to be able to adapt. You have to be able to make use of new technology. Or different shifting alliances, or more modern strategies, or shadowy networks in the case of the war against terrorism. So this piece at the Washington Times about the U.S. military and its preparedness for the next battlefield, it cites this study by the RAND Corp, or corporation. The warning, the alarm that it's sounding about how the current U.S. military, how it's poorly structured to meet the emerging threats coming from China, coming from Russia and other states. I went through President Trump's speech from Monday on yesterday's program. And at least in his case, at least he's referring to China and Russia as threats. Same with Iran. Same with radical Islamic terror. But what will the United States do? Where will it get the funding needed for this complete overhaul to modernize the U.S. military? This article says the study, this is again an article about that study from the RAND Corporation. It says the study, U.S. Military Capabilities and Forces for a Dangerous World, presents the stark conclusion that the American military needs to reform its structure and warfighting plans to better deal with military challenges. See, there's new challenges that we're facing. There's new kinds of enemies. There's new alliances. There's new technologies. It says here, put more starkly, assessments in this report will show that U.S. forces could, under plausible assumptions, lose the next war they're called upon to fight, despite the United States outspending China on military forces by a ratio of 2.7 to 1 and Russia by 6 to 1. The nation needs to do better than this, the report says. So it's not all about spending. And you hear those that say, look, we need to, if anything, we need to dismantle some of our arsenal because we're too big, we have too much power, and we spend so much more than Russia and China. Well, what about all these reports, all these mishaps, these accidents that are happening? What about how stretched thin the U.S. military is, or the diminished British military as well? I'll get to that in a second. It says here, U.S. forces have failed to keep pace with military advances by major powers while poorly postured to meet key challenges in Europe and East Asia and insufficiently trained and ready to get the most operational utility from many of its active components. That's quoting the report. And it says that this report, it echoes somewhat what General Dunford said recently. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he gave a speech last month. The chairman warned that American military advantages over China and Russia are eroding and said more investments are necessary. And Donald Trump, of course, said as much on Monday. But is all this going to be fixed just by eliminating the sequester? Just, we got to get rid of that. That's out the door. We're going to be able to carry on with this modernization program. The RAND study, it says, recommended that instead of readying military forces to fight two regional wars in overlapping time frames, the military needs to shift the focus toward battling the five main adversaries today: China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and Islamic terrorist groups. I mean, that's a lot. And put them all together, well, there's nuclear weapons right across the board there. Or at least in the last couple of cases. They're about to get them. It says the report states that the current approach to force planning and resource allocation by the Pentagon has placed too little emphasis on modernizing the capabilities, posture, and operating concepts of U.S. forces for power projection. See, too little emphasis on those things. And then finally here, it gives a couple of examples about America's adversaries and how they're gaining in strength and power. For example, to deal with China, the military needs to speed up development of faster, longer-range air-to-surface and air-to-air missiles, more stocks of regional-based cruise missiles, more electronic warfare gear, more stealth drones, and satellites hardened from attacks along with space weapons such as missiles and jammers. Many of those same weapons are needed to defeat Russia in a conflict, as well as deploying 3 heavy combat brigades in the Baltic states and 1 in Poland. There's lots of needs. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he's sounding the alarm. Here comes this report, cited here in the Washington Times. And meanwhile, here in Britain, as the Times reported today, you have cutbacks so sharp, so severe, that Britain, as of this moment, has no major warship overseas. Nowhere. Nothing. No major warships on the British Navy. No major warships on operations anywhere in the world. It's the first time, this article says, the first time that's happened in living memory. I mean, it may be the first time it's happened in centuries. The absence of any of the Royal Navy's 19 frigates and destroyers overseas was a strategic embarrassment for the country and a strategic embarrassment for defense. That's according to a senior serving military officer. All 6 Type 45 destroyers, they're in Portsmouth right now. Why? Well, it's a combination of things. You've got mechanical problems. Yeah, they're routine maintenance in some cases, and a shortage of manpower. They don't have enough people to staff the ship. And also, they want to give sailors leave over Christmas. So there you go. All of them, they're just sitting down at Portsmouth. Nowhere else in the world. What does this indicate? Is the Navy too small? Is there real power and strength that Great Britain is able to show anymore? I mean, it's just dwindled down to next to nothing. The article here, it concludes, frigates and destroyers have been the workhorses of the Navy for decades. Navy sources said that they could not recall a time when Britain had not deployed a main surface combatant on operations overseas, meaning that this could be the first time it has happened since the modern Royal Navy, known as the Senior Service, was formed some 500 years ago. 500 years ago. Which takes it way back and then comes forward all the way through to the peak of its power in the mid to late 1800s. On through to the First Great War, in which Britain played such a critical role. I mean, at that time, it was Churchill who presided over the Navy. And it was active. And it was involved. And then, of course, Churchill presided over the country, the Empire, in the 1940s, during the Second World War. What happens if there's another world war? Will Britain be ready for that kind of a conflict? Should it be ready for that kind of a conflict? What does it say about Britain's impact or influence on the world today? Where for the first time in perhaps 500 years, Britain doesn't have a frigate, it doesn't have any kind of ship from the Navy. It doesn't have anything anywhere else except for Portsmouth. Well, and while America and Britain are weakening by the day, as we've covered on this program before, simultaneous with this, you've got this massive buildup, the militarization of nations in Southeast Asia or in Eastern Europe. And really, the trend is all across the world. There's an article from AP that said Chinese warplanes, they're conducting drills in the Sea of Japan, or over the Sea of Japan. AP says this was the first time the Chinese Air Force has flown through the strait that lies between South Korea and Japan. First time that that's happened. China's military spending this year, or rather this next year, 2018, it's expected to surpass $203 billion. That's an increase of 6%. Over $192 billion this year. $192 billion. Next year, $203 billion. Flying across the Sea of Japan for the first time. And, of course, Japan, they're looking to expand their missile defense because of not just China, but the threat from North Korea. It's a trend you see all across the world, except in Great Britain, except in the United States. The highest level since the Cold War. That's the forecast. Military spending, global defense spending, it's called. It's higher now than it's been since the end of the Cold War. Where is this military buildup leading? One final piece here. This is from Real Clear Defense. It says, since the late 1990s, the concept of a second nuclear age has helped to paint a depressing picture of Asia's nuclear dynamics. It portrays in sharp contrast to the first nuclear age, a world of multiple nuclear players, some impoverished or inclined to ready use of weapons of mass destruction, few with robust conventional forces or reliable systems for command and control, and many driven by nationalism. In other words, all of these unstable countries that have nuclear weapons and more that want to get them. Quite a difference from the first nuclear age when you had the two superpowers rushing to create the first one, or I guess in the case of the World War II era, the United States and Germany, and then later the arms build up for the United States and the Soviet Union. But where is this so-called second nuclear age leading this world? Well, it is, as that article brings out. It's a depressing picture, but it's not unlike what's described in Matthew 24, Great Tribulation. For then shall be great tribulation, Jesus said. That's why he said, watch for it. That's why he said, you got to keep your eyes open. You're not going to get this on the major media news coverage. You're not going to get it on your nightly news broadcast. Like I said at the top, I mean, where is the outcry about this now forming far-right government in Austria? And how significant is this? How will this impact Eastern Europe and all of Europe for that matter? Sebastian Kurz, we've had a lot to say about him in recent weeks on this program. At thetrumpet.com, he's sworn in as Austria's new chancellor just the other day. And he's now formed this coalition together with the Freedom Party of Austria. That's the nice sounding name. FPO, Freedom Party. Headed up by Heinz Christian Strache, I guess, or Strache, however you pronounce it. But this is a party that was founded in 1956 by a former Nazi and SS officer. That's right. He was right in the thick of it. The Times of England, or London, says a far-right party will be sworn in as a coalition partner of Austria today with a mission to curb migration. I mean, that's what the discontent is over in so many of these states in Europe. They've had enough. They want to clamp down on the border security. They want to close the borders. A mission to curb migration into Europe as the new government faces accusations of racism and xenophobia, says the Freedom Party, led by Heinz Christian Strache, has been given control of the foreign, interior, and defense ministries. That's incredible. They're presiding over this group. The FPO is presiding over the foreign, interior, and defense ministries. That's quite a lot of power. The article says this will hand oversight of the army police, and intelligence services to the FPO. That's all. The Telegraph, in writing about this party, just last month, Mr. Strzok is the one who heads it up. Keep in mind, the Telegraph said a month ago, Mr. Strzok was arrested in Germany in 1989 for taking part in Hitler Youth-style torch-lit neo-Nazi rallies. He has also been photographed posing with guns alongside known neo-Nazis. Incidents documented by the committee include a Freedom Party politician who called for the concentration camp to be put back in operation. Another who posted a picture of SS troops on Facebook with the caption, "Our grandfathers were not criminals." And one of the things, again, Richard Palmer pointed this out to me this morning, but the FBO was part of a coalition back in the year 2000. And back then, this is just 17 years ago, you had all EU member states imposing a diplomatic boycott. So did Israel. The U.S. and Israel, in fact, recalled their ambassadors until one of the individuals in particular was forced to resign, one of the FBO extremists. Okay, so that was just 15, 16 years ago. This time, there's been none of that. No protesting, no diplomatic boycott, no removal of ambassadors, nothing. Nothing. I mean, this is now just par for the course. This is just another day in the EU. Nothing unusual. Nothing out of the ordinary. The EU Observer today, it says the EU has given its blessing to Austria's new government on grounds of its pro-European stance, despite its far-right element. Well, see, now we think, hey, at least they're pro-European. At least they're good, strong nationalists. What a difference. Is that alarming at all? Is anyone out there concerned about this? We will judge the Austrian government on its deeds, said European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker. Well, look, forget about this history. Forget about the past. Forget about the recent past. Forget about sporting guns alongside known neo-Nazis. Forget about neo-Nazi rallies. We're going to judge them by their actions. Concerns arose, it says, over the FPO deal due to the party's openly anti-Semitic and Nazi apologetic past. FPO fingerprints were all over Kurz's government program, which set out a tough stance on migration. It says later, the deal was the latest signal that mainstream politics in Europe had shifted to the right in the wake of the migration and economic crisis. And where is it that that crisis started? Who is the one who is responsible for starting it, primarily? Well, it was Frau Merkel opening the gates, opening the doors to millions. And, of course, Austria's closer geographically to those troubled regions, where people are fleeing, hundreds and thousands of them are. So these countries are suffering because of these wide open borders. And so here comes Sebastian Kurz's party. Here comes the FPO, the Nazi party, or the former Nazi party, the party established by a Nazi. Here comes the Alternative for Deutschland party. And that's another angle to this story. What are they doing in Germany? That Germany's in the midst of a coalition crisis right now. What kind of impact could this have on however it plays out in Germany? It says here, this is from Die Welt, Austria-Hungary and far-right echoes of history. Here's another article talking about, well, history. I think history might it might be repeating itself. It's like the resurrection of the Austro-Hungarian Empire with the rise of all of these kings, to paraphrase what we put on our recent trumpet. Where are all of these strong men coming from? It says the march of more recent history includes the watershed decision. Well, it just points to 2015 and the opening of the doors to this influx of refugees. It says later on, this is DeVelt, Kurz is now Europe's youngest leader and the FBO, the most powerful far-right party on the continent, as it controls Austria's interior, foreign, and defense ministries. This is not insignificant. It's not insignificant. Attention, listen to this. Attention will now swing back to the continent's historical power. For in Germany, too, the far-right party, Alternative for Deutschland, has become a kingmaker of sorts, albeit for different reasons. And then it goes on to talk about the election crisis that Germany's been in for 3 months now. I mean, it's a new record. The longest it's ever taken the post-war Germany to form a government was 86 days, and we've surpassed that. And they're talking now like it won't happen before Easter. Forget about Christmas. It's a crisis. Is 2018 the year that it boils over? Frau Merkel's having a hard time getting her coalition together. Her last option is the Socialist Party that was so badly bruised in the recent elections. This article says the momentum that started in 2015 continues to be with the populace. That's what they call them now, the populace. What will history hold for 2018? Euroskeptics are rising in the polls ahead of Italian national elections, and deadlocked Brexit negotiations are sure to test the very foundations of Europe. Yes, history keeps marching in Europe. In which direction? We still can't quite tell. Well, we know what direction it's headed in. You think about Revelation 17:10, the 10 kings, and then the Daniel 8 man. And you look at the weak position that Germany is in presently, currently, with these never-ending coalition talks. How will this play out in 2018? A lot of people are beginning to ask that. We're coming up to the end of the calendar year. You're going to have all of these looks back, all of these lookbacks on this past year. And then what will be the forecast? What can we expect in the next year? This article, this is from Spiegel. It says, with its current provisional government, Germany is in the process of gambling away its excellent political reputation in Europe. The country used to be considered a paragon of democracy, but many abroad, it says later, have been seeing the country in a new light. The longer the vacuum continues, the more obvious the disadvantages will become. Important decisions are being delayed. Germany's heft in Europe and the world is eroding, and perhaps most importantly, the standstill in Berlin is bolstering populist critiques of the parliamentary system and their claims that the political elite only care about their own parties and not the good of the country as a whole. Here again, history repeating itself. Look at the instability of German government in the lead up to Adolf Hitler seizing power there in the early 1930s. That's where we are. I mean, what started in 2015, and really we were the only ones telling you about it, where this was headed, how it would impact Germany, opening the floodgates to the refugees. It's gained momentum, and now you have all these shockwaves politically right across the continent. So much so that here's this far-right party started by a Nazi in 1956. It enters into the new coalition with Sebastian Kurz. And what do the EU bureaucrats say in Brussels? Well, this is good. This is good. They're pro-Europe. There's a strong nationalist spirit here. Where is this leading Europe? It's leading to the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. My father had a program recently. The world's greatest empire is hidden. That's just from a few weeks ago. The November 24th, Key of David. You can get to that at thetrumpet.com if you'd like to watch the video. All of his videos are posted there. This is from The World's Greatest Empire is Hidden, clip one.
We wrote an article in thetrumpet.com by Joshua Michels, and that's November 13, 2017, and he says, the German military strategists prepare for the European Union and the United States of America to fall. They don't have confidence in America, and they know that the European Union is going to fall apart. They now have 27 nations, and God says there will only be 10 kings in that Holy Roman Empire. It's going to be pared down greatly. 10 kings. Now you can count to 10. We can all count to 10 and just watch it all happen. It's going to happen before your eyes. And God says they are going to cause the greatest bloodshed ever on this earth. And with all that nuclear power, well, I don't think it takes too much of an imagination to understand that.
That's from my father's program, November 24th, just a few weeks ago, talking about German military strategists. They understand the United States is weakening. The United States is in a free fall. And they know, too, that the European Union is going to fall apart. There's just going to be 10 kings. I mean, they may not know the specifics of the 10. We know that because of prophecy. But they know that Germany has to be the dominant force. And right now, politically, it's not. Not like it used to be because of this coalition crisis, this ongoing crisis now going beyond 3 months. There's going to be some big changes in Germany in the near future. Could it be in 2018? Look at what's happening already in Austria. Look at how fast it's happened. In Austria, bordering Germany, there to the south. Where is this continent-wide turmoil leading? All of Europe, and of course, Germany in particular. One more quote here from my father's program, clip two.
But notice we're going to have another man come on the scene in this end time who's going to lead the Holy Roman Empire. That's what this prophecy is all about in Daniel 8 and verse 23. Daniel is only for this end time today. It tells you that in Daniel 12, verse 4 and verse 9. Notice what it says in verse 23. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding, dark sentences, shall stand up. Well, now, who could that man be? Well, is Satan already preparing him? We believe that is absolutely true, and we believe you can understand probably who he is. Our literature will discuss that.
That's my father from November 24th, his Key of David program, taking you through verses there from Daniel 8, verse 23 in particular. He referenced Daniel 12 as well. There's another verse in chapter 11 that talks about the man, the Daniel 8 man, the strong man, coming in by flatteries. Big changes ahead for Europe and for Germany. And speaking about the road ahead, I'll just conclude with this article here from Project Syndicate. Complacency will be tested in 2018. Here's a forecast by Stephen Roach. On the economy, we know it's going to be a worldwide economic crisis that really serves as the catalyst to bring a lot of these prophecies to bear. It says, despite seemingly robust indicators, the world economy may not be nearly as resilient to shocks and systemic challenges as the consensus view seems to believe. In particular, the absence of a classic vigorous rebound from the Great Recession means that the global economy never recouped the growth lost in the worst downturn in modern times. So there never really was a full recovery in the traditional sense. And so here is Stephen Roach, the economist, saying, you know, we better not get too complacent here. There still are some warning signs. It says, after years of post-crisis despair, the broad consensus of forecasters is now quite upbeat about prospects for the global economy in 2018. World GDP growth is viewed as increasingly strong, synchronous, and inflation-free. Exuberant financial markets could hardly ask for more. He says, while I have great respect for the forecasting community and the collective wisdom of financial markets, I suspect that today's consensus of complacency will be seriously tested in 2018. Indeed, it will be. Jesus said, watch and pray always. And that's what we're doing. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
3 weeks ago on this program, we talked a little bit about Sigmund Freud and the impact that he had on the swing from the old morality over to the new during the 20th century. That program title, by the way, The Sexual Counter-Revolution, How Did We Get to Where We Are? It's from November 30th, again, just 2-3 weeks ago. So if you'd like to listen to that show, you can locate it on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show box or page on the Trumpet.com website. In any event, we dwell on this some in the Principles of Living class here at God's College as well. Mr. Armstrong, Herbert Armstrong, had a lot to say in The Missing Dimension in Sex, and God Speaks Out in the New Morality book about this wild swing from the old morality, the Western world steeped in the old morality thinking of the 19th century, over to the sexual revolution and the wild swing to the other extreme, the so-called new morality. And when you think about or talk about that wild swing to the opposite extreme, again, you have to look at some of the revolutionary theories of Sigmund Freud And the impact, as he, as I explained in that program 3 weeks ago, just the impact that he had on science and technology, or rather psychology. He basically was the originator of that. But here he was growing up in Vienna in the mid-1800s in all kinds of illicit sexual affairs. And as I mentioned at the top of the program, in the habit of smoking cocaine. He was addicted to cocaine for 10, 15 years. I mean, he was a scholar. He was into scholarly studies. And he hated religion. But look at the impact his theories had on the 20th century. The Encyclopedia Britannica. It says about Freud, except for his brief collaboration with Breuer, Freud, for more than a decade, stood completely isolated from the medical world, and his theories, when not completely ignored, were the object of ridicule. It was not until 1902 that several young doctors began to gather around him with the intention of learning and practicing psychoanalysis. So here is the father of psychoanalysis, or the founder, treating, as he did, treating mental or emotional disorders by emphasizing the importance of the patient, talking freely about himself, especially about his early childhood experiences and such, his dreams. And as Mr. Armstrong said, I mean, he theorized that basically all of these neuroses were caused by sexual repression. So what was the solution then? What was the fix? Well, going back to this point, the fact that his ideas and thoughts were isolated and ridiculed even, and you can see why with more and more honest research, like in the National Review, and this National Review piece by Kyle Smith, he bases his column on a book, Frederick Cruz, Freud, The Making of an Illusion. Smith titles his column Sigmund Freud. It says here, writing to his close friend and collaborator William Fleece in 1890, Sigmund Freud explained that he couldn't pay a visit because in a struggling psychiatric practice that succored rich society women in Vienna, it quotes Freud saying, "My most important client is just now going through a kind of nervous crisis and might get well in my absence. I mean, I've got to stay here. I can't come visit you," in other words. I've got to stay here and take advantage of her while I can. Smith writes, "No, Freud wasn't being ironic. He depended on grand dames to stay in business. He depended on taking advantage of these wealthy, these rich, troubled women." It talks later on about, again, this book by Frederick Cruz, a book that I'll have to get at some point, The Making of an Illusion. And it talks about Freud's lust for fame and riches, and how that he relentlessly pursued those lusts by one faddish quack remedy after another, backing away. This is quoting from the article paraphrasing the book. Backing away when justified criticism made his position untenable, covering his tracks with misleading or even completely false claims about what he'd been up to, then bustling on to the next gold mine. That's all that he was. Besides mentally unstable himself, he was a gold digger. In 1884, for instance, in the giddy throes of a fondness for cocaine that Freud would indulge on and off for some 15 years, he had the marvelous idea of treating a brilliant young scientist, Ernst Fleischl von Marxow, for a mild morphine addiction resulting from surgery by putting the patient on cocaine. That was what he suggested. That's what he needed, the treatment. Instead, Fleischl became hugely addicted to both morphine and cocaine. Sleepless nights, strung out dozy days, and wasted away into a scarecrow. While Freud writing about the patient under a pseudonym, bragged in a paper about the tremendous success of his experiment. He just would write anything. The case for Freud's misogyny is ludicrously easy to make. After his cocaine frenzy, Freud headed to Paris to study with Jean-Martin Charcot, who oversaw an insane asylum full of women upon whom he freely experimented and operated under the assumption that they were suffering from hysteria, an almost exclusively feminine phenomenon in which sex organs supposedly caused otherwise unexplained behavior and bodily disorders. Freud would carry the concept of hysteria to breathtaking extremes in his private practice. Leg pain, morphine addiction, asthma. Freud treated patients with these disorders under the working theory that they were suffering from hysteria, which among his mostly female clientele morphed into an assumption that the origin story of all neurosis was a childhood sexual trauma. It says a little bit later, if the patient couldn't remember any childhood sexual trauma, Freud would reconstruct it by coaching her to devise one. I mean, it just goes on and on. Diagnosis first, it says later on, and then make the facts fit. He concludes his piece. What Freud brought to it was mainly borrowed from Fleiss, ideas about sexual latency, bisexuality. Well, I don't need to go into it more. It tells about even how his crazy ideas were stolen. That was the world. That was the world of psychology or psychoanalysis coming into the 20th century. Freud had decided, Herbert Armstrong wrote in The Missing Dimension in Sex, he had decided. He made this decision. He didn't have the facts supporting it. He decided it. He decided that sexual repression, the attitude of shame, and ignorance about sex were the causes of neuroses and many mental disorders. He and his followers in the newly appearing profession of psychiatry urged knowledge dissemination and freedom and sexual freedom as the panacea. He says, this is Mr. Armstrong, if repression and self-denial cause the neurotic disquiet, why not reverse the interpretation of morality, emancipate the people from restraints, put a new definition on sex, define it as good, not degrading, shameful, and evil, any use of sex, in or out of marriage. And so it was the beginning of a wild swing from the old morality thinking that the world was steeped in for centuries. This wild swing over to the absolute opposite extreme where anything goes. And that's the way we've been living for decades. And now here you have all these authorities, so-called, now coming forward trying to draw lines or to establish boundaries when we've been living without them now for generations. Well, good luck with fixing that if you don't have the Bible to turn to. If you don't have the Bible as a foundation, they're not going to be able to fix it. But why can't we go back to the beginning and how all of this started and see how flawed it was, a false basic premise if ever there was one. And then actually correct the wrong at the cause. It's not going to happen. I mean, his legacy, Freud's, it lives on. The damage has already been done. And now here we are, and how sad it is to see people running around trying to establish some sense of morality, some sense of right behavior when it comes to relations between men and women, and they're not going to be able to find it. Man has never been able to find it. There's a way which seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. Mr. Armstrong explained in God Speaks Out on the New Morality how that the way that seemed logical and right, given the problems with the old morality, the way that seemed logical and right was to reverse it and institute instead a new morality, accepting sex and anything having to do with sex as good. I mean, and it cures neuroses. So this is a good thing to free ourselves, to revolt against societal standards that had existed for centuries leading up to that point. It says in a Plain Truth article, this is from 1971, Sigmund Freud attributed the cause of neuroses and mental disorders to the prudish repression and ignorance. The psychoanalysts urged sex education and sexual freedom as the cure, but the new tidal wave of sex instruction was wholly materialistic and sensual. The all-important dimension was missing, the purpose of sex and marriage. Man just did what seemed right and ended up going from one extreme to the other. And in both, the all-important missing dimension, the all-important dimension, God's dimension, it was missing. The purpose of sex and marriage. You can study a lot more on that in Mr. Armstrong's book, The Missing Dimension in Sex, which we make available at no cost or obligation to you. It's there, free. Upon request, you can order your copy at thetrumpet.com website. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.